stupid boy. I'm going to... Sorry, I'm just talking about my cat, not Tom.
We know there can be some confusion.
Stupid boy with his stupid black hair.
With his pointy ears, man. Oh my god.
Always late to the record.
Always biting people's hands. My god, so rude.
Hello, and welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn about anything and everything interesting and kind of sciencey. Today we will be covering a big science topic, we will be answering a science question, and we'll be dipping into a miscellaneous topic. I am Ella, and today I'm covering the big science topic, and we will be talking about the Russian silver fox domestication experiments.
I have no clue what this
is. Oh my gosh! Literally yesterday I was like, I wish one of us should maybe do something on domestication, because I forget what I saw. Maybe I just saw a dog and I was like, what's on domestication? That's amazing.
I love the idea. You just see a dog and they're like, oh.
that could be a topic. It's like, Hey, you on the street, stop. You got what it takes to be a topic.
Seeing inspiration everywhere, apparently.
Jesus
Christ. So dumb.
I've only heard bits of this. I'm very excited to dive deep into this.
I know very, very, very little about this, so I'm very excited.
Nice.
My name's Caroline, and I'm doing this episode's question, which is, what is the world's oldest potted plant?
Oh my gosh! What a fun question. As someone,
it's a fun one, right?
With a plethora.
Yeah, it's going to be a very short topic this week because there is like a definitive answer, but I thought it'd be fun to talk about.
Oh, that's great.
That's okay. We can, I will, what we'll do to make it longer is I will guess every single potted plant until we hit it.
That's absolute. I had never considered that question in my life. This is exciting.
Actually, I'll talk about how I got to this question when we're doing it, because it is fun. Yeah.
My name's Tom, and today's miscellaneous topic is 10 letters across, and the clue is what an angrily written letter might contain.
I'm really bad at words.
Crosswords.
Oh my god.
I thought it was crosswords, and then it was like, what an angry written letter might contain.
Crosswords.
Oh, yes, very good. I cannot explain to you how bad I am at crosswords or any kind of word game, so.
Yeah.
Well, Ella, I mean, to give a tease, the story of this is how I started hating these at first and then learned to love them. So I hopefully will be able to convince you likewise, but we'll see.
Interesting.
Okay.
I'm planning on converting some people today.
If anyone can convince me, you can, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you. And maybe I can convince y'all to join a Patreon.
Oh my god! Shameless.
Shameless, truly.
We recently uploaded our stretch goal of trying the spiciest hot sauce on chicken wings.
And it's a video. It's like a full video, almost 50 minutes long.
And we all were suffering very greatly.
We also got to learn a bit about each other, which was really nice.
Yeah, it was lovely.
And you can find the link to that at letslearneverythingpod.com.
Today's main topic is the silver fox domestication experiment. Experiment singular, because it's a single one that's been going on for a long time.
Interesting.
Before I start, I want to say thanks to Red and Flashy on TikTok, who tagged our Let's Learn Everything TikTok account in a video by Marie Does Stuff, who talked about this and inspired me to make the... I'd heard about it before, but she added a little bit of science to it, and I was like, oh, this is really interesting, and it got me into it. Also, most of my information today comes from, or rather the bones of it, came from an article published in Biomed Central by Lee Allen Dugatkin. And the link is in the show notes, but also, I have lots of references today.
Yay!
So, first of all, do you guys sound like you might have heard of this before?
I haven't.
Yeah, So to briefly explain the, like, shower thought I had the other day, like, literally a few days ago, I was like, what makes an animal domesticated?
That's such an interesting question.
And I think, if I believe, that's sort of like the root of the question of the experiment. I think I read this on like Reddit like years and years ago as just like a single headline, and like maybe I read one comment on it about how they tried to domesticate a fox. I literally don't know what happened, how valid it is. You know, like this was like a maybe like a pop sci headline a decade ago.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious to like really dig into what, how much of it is true, how much of it is correct in the popular belief. But basically, my understanding is there was an experiment where they tried to, over generations, domesticate a fox.
That's basically it. But there's a lot to it, right? There's a lot of meat in this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an ongoing experiment which began in 1959. So it's now 62 years in the running.
Whoa, it's still presently going.
Yes, at least it was 3 years ago, and I haven't seen anything that says it stopped.
I had no idea about that.
Yeah, so it's a team of Russian geneticists have been attempting to domesticate silver foxes through selective breeding. So much in the way dogs were domesticated from wolves, except with much more intent and probably in a much shorter time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about the history and the findings of the study, but first I want to talk a little bit about the domestication of dogs.
Yes, because I don't know how that works.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't either, and it's actually so interesting. So many of the details of domestication of wolves to dogs, such as how the relationship began and the time frame it happened, are still unresolved and quite disputed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But it's thought to have happened somewhere in the range of 15,000 to 40,000 years ago, so a pretty big time frame.
Whew. But also not too far in the grand scheme of things, of like evolution, I suppose.
I mean, humans...
Maybe I'm wrong.
Human civilization isn't even that old, so...
Yeah, yeah.
Domesticated dogs are older than human civilization. Not older than humans, but...
That's insane.
I really appreciate these benchmarks, because when we throw numbers around, it's very easy to get lost in the sauce. So this is great. Okay, yes.
So hypotheses on how they were domesticated include early hunter-gatherers taming and breeding wolves, or wolves domesticating themselves by scavenging from humans and becoming tamer in successive generations. But these are just ideas. Here's what we definitely do know. Dogs were the first domesticated animal, so before livestock.
Oh!
That's so interesting.
Huh.
Because we weren't farming by that point.
Yeah.
It's also before we did any kind of farming, so any planting of, like, grains or rice.
Oh, wow!
I would have 100% put money on, like, cows or sheep.
I would have at least said, like plant, like, crop farming before domestication of dogs. That's crazy.
I would have
too.
Wow! The specific species of wolf from which dogs are derived is extinct. Or not the species, but at least the population, so wherever they were in the world.
Do we know what species it was?
I think it's the grey wolf, but it's like a different type. Basically, whatever that form of that the grey wolf was, it's no longer around. And the earliest dogs were domesticated somewhere in Eurasia. We know that it was definitely in that big landmass, not in Africa or the Americas.
Oh, wow.
So this understanding of these things comes from genetic and archaeological evidence from both modern and ancient dogs and wolves. And I found one piece of evidence, like, particularly interesting. So under a 4,800-year-old monument in Ireland, Dan Bradley from Trinity College Dublin found a small triangle-shaped piece of skull from an ancient dog. Geneticist Gregor Larson and colleagues were able to get enough DNA from the bone to sequence the whole dog's genome.
This is around
a 5,000-year-old dog.
Wow.
They compared the sequence against the sequences of hundreds of modern dogs. Mm-hmm. And analysis revealed that there was a genetic divergence between East Asian and Western Eurasian dogs in the range of 14 to 6,000 years ago. So this split happens from a population of dogs thought to have arisen somewhere in China.
Mm-hmm.
But the oldest dog fossils from both this west and eastern areas are older than the split, which means there were already dogs in the west. So this basically suggests that dogs were domesticated from two separate wolf populations independently on either side of the world at around the same time.
Whoa. What strikes me as so interesting is that, and maybe you'll dive into this in a second, but like you know, I feel like we've talked about sort of like, what's it called? Convergent evolution before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what's interesting about domestication is it feels like deeply sociological in nature, yeah. right? But at the same time, genetic. And so, I mean, like, I don't know if I could even give a solid answer for what, like, domestication, like,
I was about to say, I love the idea that, like, two completely different parts of the ancient world, humans and wolves, interacted yeah. in such a specific way that it led to yeah. this partnership, like a kind of genetic destiny.
Wow.
Because they're mm-hmm. so inclined to, like, form that kind of role with each other, which I love.
Yeah, like, I got a little chills.
We were always going to, cool. like, domesticate dogs, basically. That's so interesting.
I know, it's amazing. But I will say that this hypothesis that they arose in two different places, there are criticisms of this.
Mm-hmm.
So in an article for The Atlantic, Bob Wayne from the University of California says, "I'm somewhat underwhelmed since it's a single specimen," which is, yeah, makes fair. Sense. Wayne and his yeah. team compared the mitochondrial genome of 126 modern dogs and wolves and 18 fossils, and concluded that dogs were domesticated somewhere in Europe or Western Siberia between 18 and 32,000 years ago. But
wow.
a lot of other studies have kind of gone more with the China aspect. Yeah. So it's not clear, mm-hmm. but I personally, I'm totally now on board with the two different yeah. areas idea. But that's, I'm not going to go any further into dog domestication. I just thought this was a nice little interesting bit of background.
No, yeah. super. Yeah.
So moving on to the Russian silver fox domestication experiment. So we start a bit further back in 1868. Charles Darwin publishes not the book you're thinking of, but a book called The Variation.
One of his prequels?
one of his sequels, The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication. So in the book, Darwin notes that the domesticated
If you're a real Charles Darwin fan, name three of his books. Besides Origin of Species. Everyone knows Origin of Species. That's his closer. That's his encore. Everyone knows that one.
Well, Origin of Species came before this. So
okay.
And there was some gaps. Basically, there were gaps in the ideas there. And, and this is how he filled mm-hmm. them in with his other work. So in this
cool.
particular work, he notes that domesticated animals exhibit shared characteristics even between different species, including having floppier ears, shorter, curlier curlier tails, juvenile faces and behavior, spotted coats, which is called piebaldism, shorter muzzles, smaller teeth, and reduced levels of stress hormones, plus a few other factors.
Okay, so it's interesting because, you know, I think some of these make more intuitive sense, like the teeth, right? In terms of if yeah. they are doing less, I don't know, like hunting and mm-hmm. needing to yeah. kill necessarily. But I'm sure some of these all have like a deeper reason to them. But it is funny because I'm just like, yeah, that's just a dog. That's just more like a dog. Like
yeah.
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So it's interesting.
But the observation was this wasn't just dogs. This was most other domesticated species, including birds and livestock.
Including birds?
Yeah. Not, you know, they might not have floppy ears because they're birds, but they had other aspects of this.
They just started, yeah, sprouting out. Yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
Darwin knew that there was some reason for this, but he did not quite know why. And it might seem obvious to us now why these things are connected, but this was published years before there was any real science of genetics.
Yeah.
So wow, yeah.
Mendel, who's kind of considered the father of genetics, he laid the foundations.
Right.
The pea man.
Yeah, he laid the foundations for heredity and genetics by breeding garden peas. We all know it. He had only just recently published his work. So this was like such a new area of science.
What a fucking time to be alive. My God.
Didn't Mendel also publish his work in like a different language? So it was basically like completely inaccessible to a lot of the science community.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Was he German, I think?
Wow.
I think he was either Austrian or German, yeah.
Well.
So there was a bit of a delay in it.
That
as well,
might have actually been
interesting.
Yeah, part of yeah. the reason Darwin was slowed down.
This is like the Woodstock of science. My gosh.
This was also when microscopes were really coming up real strong as well, so
wow.
I'm picturing one of those like rock star biopics where like music's playing in the background and it's like at the same time microscopes.
I'm not gonna go through like the whole history of genetics and how this all came around because that would take so long and I want to get to this thing. But let's skip ahead about 80 years later. Okay, so in the 1940s, 1950s, and Russian geneticist Dmitry Bileyev was working at the Institute for Fur Breeding Animals in Moscow. And through his work there and his reading of Darwin's book, Bileyev hypothesized that the traits Darwin described and he saw in the animals he worked with were associated with animals that interact pro-socially, or in other words, with tameness towards humans. And so these traits were selectively bred for. And those things led to changes in patterns of gene expression. So nature rather than nurture.
Yeah. That phrase pro-socially is interesting. I feel like it's a lot less loaded than, and like less anthropomorphic than domestication.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm like, okay, I can see that more being sort of like a genetic thing possibly.
Well, let me ruin that immediately, because this thing that he described, this thing that he described is now known as domestication syndrome. That's what they call it.
Interesting.
This idea of, yeah, exactly. It's strange, isn't it? All of these traits that Darwin described is together called domestication syndrome. So in order to test this hypothesis, he wanted to domesticate an animal from scratch. And he chose a silver fox, which is a melanistic form of a red fox, so an increased amount of black pigmentation. But it's the same species as the red fox. And one of the reasons for choosing foxes is that although they have never been domesticated properly, farm breeding of
foxes... They're super cute.
They are.
Sorry.
Well, farm breeding of foxes began in the 19th century and was very successful because they have a better temperament in captivity. Huh. So it was it seemed like a good choice to him. And I also think, as an interesting side note, the red fox and the domestic dog are very closely related species. They they diverged about 10 million years ago within the Canidae family. So I wonder if this family of animals is more generally disposed to being domesticated. But that's just me thinking, which I'm allowed to do.
I mean, if, you know, just approaching this from like a general point of view, it makes more sense than like a giraffe, I suppose, which is like another thought you could have, right?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, but imagine giraffes with floppy ears.
Yeah.
Oh no!
They have the piebald
cone. Pretty concrete art in the Discord server. Please make a giraffe with floppy ears. That'd be so wonderful.
Okay, so it's 1959 and Bileyev starts to selectively breed these silver foxes. The project was led by him and Lyudmila Trut, who is currently 87 and still the lead of the project.
Oh. Wow! I was going to ask if there was any folks still...
Yeah, I was so curious, like, if they would be able to actually complete this research within their lifetimes or not. That's really cool.
Yeah, well, it happened a lot quicker than I think anyone anticipated. So their team basically assessed hundreds of foxes for tameness, and the top 10% would be chosen to contribute to the next generation. So tameness here basically means... this pro-social idea, the ease with which an animal can form social bonds with a species other than its own.
I want you to know, because I imagine, they're testing these social bonds. I'm, like, literally picturing The Bachelor in my mind. Like, there's this scientist up there and, like, going on dates with each of the foxes and being like, so what do you like? And the fox is like, yip, yip. And it's like, you get a rose. You get one of my 10 roses.
It's crazy. You're not so far from... It's not quantitative, you know, it's not like a numbers-based game.
Yeah.
They really have to do it based on, like, how they perceive the foxes interacting with them.
Interesting.
But it's interesting because, you know, normally that would be a subjective, totally subjective beyond reproach, but it is the subjective measure, right?
Exactly.
Because that's the basis. It's human, it's like a Turing test, right?
Oh, that's such a good way to describe it, yeah. It's subjective.
I'm going to
read from a 1999 paper by the lead researcher Trut, explaining what they did specifically with the foxes. So this is from the paper. To evaluate the foxes for tameness, we give them a series of tests. When a pup is 1 month old, an experimenter offers it food from his hand while trying to stroke and handle the pup. The pups are tested twice, once in a cage and once while moving freely with other pups in an enclosure, where they can choose to either make contact with the human experimenter or with another pup.
Oh.
The test is repeated monthly until the pups are 6 or 7 months old. At 7 or 8 months, when the foxes reach sexual maturity, they are scored for tameness and assigned to one of three classes. The least domesticated foxes, Those that flee from experimenters or bite when stroked or handled are assigned to class 3.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Foxes in class 2 let themselves be petted and handled, but show no emotionally friendly response to experimenters.
Stop.
Yeah, okay. Interesting.
Out of the quote now. That is so subjective.
Yeah.
What is emotional responsiveness? But I guess it's the way that we perceive dogs as being emotionally responsive to us, right?
True, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, back into the quote. Foxes in class 1 are friendly toward experimenters, wagging their tails and whining. In the 6th generation, aww, bred for tameness, we had to add an even higher scoring category. Members, whoa, of class 1E,
oh, so cool,
the domesticated elite. They are, ooh, eager to establish human they are eager to establish human contact, whimpering to attract attention, and sniffing and licking experimenters like dogs.
Oh my.
They start,
God,
displaying this behavior before they're even 1 month old.
Wow.
How amazing is that?
This is literally like a, I want to say like an anime plot where it's like they were so advanced we had to add a new class.
Yeah.
It's, that's so cool.
That was 6th generation, so that would have been anywhere in the range of like 6 to 10 years, but super quickly.
Wow.
Absolutely bonkers. Absolutely bonkers.
So you see, they score on tameness, and that's the only selection criteria. They don't look at any of those other characteristics.
Yeah.
So I think this project is now about over 50 generations in.
Oh my God.
But in just 10 generations, 18% of the fox pups were in the elite category. After 20 generations, 35% were elite. And by 1999, when this paper came out, 70 to 80% were elite. So basically dogs.
Oh my God.
They are docile, eager to please, and want human attention.
Oh. Oh my Same. Goodness.
Same. That's all I think.
And Belaev's hypothesis seemed to be becoming more and more accurate because the characteristics of domestication syndrome emerged in these foxes. These,
wow,
the kind of elite tame foxes had. They have floppy ears, curly tails, spotted coats, and much lower levels of stress hormones.
Oh,
and,
wow,
and shorter muzzles, all these, wow, kind of like, wow, dog-like features.
Wow.
I'm going to share with you guys a picture of the first domesticated fox to have floppy ears.
I'm so excited!
Because it's cute as fuck.
We are linking this directly. This is going to be the top. If you go to the sources, this is going to be the top. It's going to be right at the top.
Okay. This is Mecta.
Gosh.
Mecta?
Or who is, which means dream. And I mean, other than being exceptionally cute, what strikes you about Mecta?
Floppy ears. I mean, it looks like a dog. It literally
exactly.
just looks like a dog.
It literally, they look so dog-like. Every the ones now that I've seen pictures of, the more modern ones, they do have a few more fox features. I think they tried to breed those in. But
yeah.
They do look, they became so dog-like so quickly.
That is so interesting.
Wow.
Also, look how cute he is.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, if you showed me a picture of this and like 4 other dogs, I would be like, you just showed me 5 great dogs.
What is... I showed wow. someone else this picture and they thought it was a dog. They were like, oh, it's like a fox dog. So as time went on, these foxes had also had a smaller adrenal glands. So they produced less adrenaline, less kind of fear response.
Wow.
They had high levels of serotonin and they just acted what research described as happier. And several studies have actually compared the genomes of the domesticated foxes against the genome of foxes which have been selectively bred to be more aggressive.
Interesting.
And it really seems to confirm Belaev's hypothesis that domestication has this really large genetic component. So in 2018, one study compared the tame group, the aggressive group, and a farm-bred group, the genomes of them, and they identified an area on fox chromosome 15 that seemed to be associated with domestication behaviours. And one gene in this area, SOR-CS, is a protein expressed in neurons, and it's associated with synaptic plasticity, which are changes that occur in the junctions between neurons that allow them to communicate, for those who don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And these changes are often associated with memory and learning.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So this is all quite interesting, I think. Now we're getting some evidence that we have, like, these phenotypic or physical and genetic changes that seem to show that domestication is
just so interesting that, like, in theory, and there is some evidence for the idea that, like, we can attribute domestication to essentially one gene on one chromosome.
I will say that this one gene has something to do with it, but it's more...
okay.
They think it's a much, much larger
set
of genes and changes. And actually, we'll get into that now, because Believ had this genetics hypothesis, but he didn't know what the mechanism after the genetics was, so the step between the genetic and physical changes. But one proposed mechanism from 2014 is something called the neural crest cell hypothesis. I think this is so interesting, and this is what made me want to do it.
Oh, yes.
So early in the development of vertebrates, you get a group of stem cells called neural crest cells, which go on to migrate around the body and give rise to other cell types like cartilage and bone in the head, smooth muscle, melanocytes, which produce the pigment melanin, which causes darker skin and fur, and some neurons as well. So the hypothesis posits that in domestication syndrome, there are dozens of genetic changes which cause these neural crest cells, their migration and proliferation differentiation to be changed and reduced. And thereby, some of the tissues have reduced numbers of neural crest cells. So what this basically means is things like...
Okay.
For the physical changes, you might have... If you have reduced number of neural crest cells where the ear forms, for example, it means there's less cartilage forming. And so it means you have...
No way!
Floppier ears. If you have fewer melanocytes from neural crest cells, it means less melanin, and it means a spottier coat.
Get out of town! I literally, at the start, I was like, some of these make sense and some don't. And I was like, I guess we'll never know. Wow.
Behaviorally, neural crest cells become something called adrenal medullary cells, which produce adrenaline, which is associated with fear and stress. So fewer neural crest cells, you have less adrenal medullary cells, you have less adrenaline, less fear. You get the point.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Wow.
This is obviously like a huge oversimplification. There's lots of steps in between.
Yeah.
And the people behind this hypothesis, Wilkins, Rangham and Fitch, they lay out really well in this 2014 paper if you want to look at it.
Amazing.
But I think it's so interesting, and it makes so much sense. It seems like really intuitively makes sense. So when looking at the genetics of Believ's domesticated foxes, changes in the genes involved in neural crest cell formation, migration and differentiation have been reported in those foxes, and there seems to be genetic data from other domesticated wild and ancient animals supporting the idea too. But I'm not super clear on the area after reading around. It seems like it's still very much a working hypothesis.
Yeah.
Research being done. So I'd say take this
with
more than a grain of salt, but don't claim it as fact, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a hypothesis.
Yeah, totally.
I will say, this is really, I can't talk about this for time, but there's actually another political layer to this story, which is so fascinating. The domestication study was almost completely shut down by the Soviet Union in the year it began, in 1959, because it basically almost became illegal to study Mendelian genetics due to the spread of a pseudoscience by a biologist called Trofim Lysenko. His bad research actually led to massive crop failure and famine in the Soviet Union.
Oh, wow.
The Russian fox experiment just managed to keep on going, which is great. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get into all of this or Trofim Lysenko, because we'll be here forever. But
yeah.
I definitely mend people listening, look him up.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, there's a great episode of the podcast Behind the Bastards covering Lysenko called The Russian Scientist Who Helped Kill 30 Million.
Wow, scathing.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
Instead, I think this episode we're going to focus on the Russian scientists that made cuter foxes.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Maybe not a great Behind the Bastard episode, but still.
Yeah, the Russian scientists who helped make cute foxes. I love it. But anyway, there we go. I just want to end by talking about some of the criticisms of the domestication study and the idea of domestication syndrome, because we have to...
I was going
to
ask, because it's...
It almost seems too perfect.
Yeah, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I am really glad that you keep reiterating that, like, these are many hypotheses, yeah. And it's all extremely complicated. So I'm very curious, because if I can just like throw some stuff on the wall, like part of me wonders, with a study that is so subjective, if there are, you know, sort of like leaky methodologies in any way.
Yeah.
You know,
like, also just
how
like,
much of this is nature nurture kind of like
a study that relies so heavily on human interaction throughout it. Like, you wonder if all of these things are because they're learning about human interaction rather than the actual genetics.
Yes, I totally agree.
There's clearly a lot of nurture going along with the nature. It's not just one. Yeah.
Yeah. So a paper published in Trends in Ecology and Evolution in 2019 gives genetic evidence that the foxes in Belair's experiment weren't wild, but obtained from a Canadian fur farm.
Ooh.
Whoa!
Yeah. Where the traits of Belaev's domestication syndrome, they were already present, like the spotted coat, for example.
No.
But it's not confirmed. Belaev said that he got these wild foxes, and it's possible that there's just overlapping genetic. But it's also possible that he did get them from there, because as I said, he knew that there were already partly domesticated foxes there.
Yeah. That's
interesting. Very interesting.
Wow.
Belaev also started the experiment with a relatively small population of 130 foxes, so it could have made traits spread more quickly.
Do we know how many individuals he has now?
There are now 100 fully domesticated foxes, or at the count in 2018, but they have a lot more than that because they're the elite.
Interesting.
This paper, the criticizer of them, kind of concludes not that domestication syndrome isn't real, but that it may be overstated. They put more focus on selective pressures of animals living around humans, like altered food sources and safer breeding and living.
Yeah.
Which I think is probably very true.
It's sort of interesting, like, how would we design a control experiment for this, right? Where, like, you would do these same tests, but maybe not. There's so many factors.
I think it's almost impossible to control this. I think the way that Belaev did it, where they just had this single trait of tameness that they did, is probably one of the closest ways you'll get to this being controlled.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't play with, I mean, I'm sure they did play with them, but they didn't keep them as pets in their homes. They were just, but anyway, but I mean, But what was so interesting and funny to me about reading this criticism is there is a fully cited and referenced critique to this paper from Professor Fitch in the comments section of the paper.
Oh, incredible. What? I love scientists so much. We're all so sassy.
It's so good. Yeah.
Journals do have comment sections, and you do get other scientists like fully like bashing out critiques in them.
Oh, wow. So
this is from Professor Fitch, who was one of the three people who came up with that hypothesis for the neural crest cells. And the comment, it basically boils down to saying that they really do think domestication syndrome is real, but it's just for one aspect of a multifaceted phenomenon of domestication.
Yeah.
Right? They're not saying it explains everything, and that both can exist. Both the criticism of domesticated syndrome and their idea can coexist.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that's primarily their think about the neural crest changes. So I think this seems like a pretty reasonable approach to the idea. Genetics are complicated and intertwined and undoubtedly impacted by environmental factors. We understand that more and more as we understand things like epigenetics. So there's no real answer, but I think the real answer of all of this is that domesticated fox is cute.
They're cute. Very, very cute.
It's cute.
Would like one as pet. Should never have one.
Although it's not like keeping a wild fox or just a wild tamed fox, because they can be trained, unlike wild foxes.
What happens?
Please do not get a domesticated fox unless you have space to keep the domesticated fox.
Please don't steal foxes from the wild and try to domesticate them. That's bad.
From what I understand is some of these gets, because after they've been bred for the domestication, they don't keep all of them. They'll send them out to people who want them, but you need a lot of space for them because they're like big dogs. They need lots of space to run around, and they're very excitable. So anyway, there you go.
Oh,
I love it's so great to think about these theories, but I'm also really glad that there is an active discussion to this day about some of this stuff. I would much rather it be complicated than be so simple, if that makes sense. And it's it's really neat.
It's really interesting. When I was reading an article about the dog domestication stuff, one of the kind of leading scientists in the area said that he called a meeting where he got all of these people with these different ideas together in a room. And the person interviewing was like, was that strange? You know, and he's like, yeah, you know, you're in a room with people who are basically saying you're doing bad science. But ultimately, it just dissipated so quickly because even if we're wrong, we all want to know the truth.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I was like, that's perfect.
Wow. You love to see it. That's amazing. That's what it could be is. Yeah, I know a lot of these researchers probably have pressures about like getting funding. You know, you have to like make these grand statements and stuff like that. So it's really cool that for them to all, that's an amazing story that they all we all just want to learn.
That seeing that kind of thing gives me hope. There's so much competition in science. There can be a lot of venom.
Yeah.
But I also think it's probably unfair to compare this kind of area of evolutionary biology because they are so underfunded that no one's getting any money anyway. So they really... if you're doing it, it's because you really, really care about it.
Wow.
So, but it does give me hope.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
I love that.
I did want to ask which... if there was an animal in the world that you wish could be... humanity's best friend, much like dogs, what would it be?
Honestly, I love foxes, so like the fact that this is like potentially something I could have within my lifetime is a domesticated fox. I'm so psyched about it.
If there was an animal that is already insanely cute that I just want to hang out with, possibly otters. I think that'd be very fun. And then they could go and catch me little fish and bring them back.
I totally think that otters give me vibes that they could be domesticated.
Yeah, for sure. They already
got floppy ears.
What about you, Tom?
My first thought was a whale would be amazing. just have a big sea friend would be wild. But then also bats would be great, little guys.
Another one I think could be domesticated. Yeah. They're mammals.
They're
dogs. They're so cute. God, but you mean fruit bats, because that's what everyone means when they say bats. You don't mean like vampire bats, you know?
Or like the teeny tiny bats that are like this big.
Hey, listen, I'll take what I can get. I'll take whatever friend will have me.
I'm curious if we could domesticate like really intelligent animals like dolphins.
I think yes, but only because it's like I'm doing this because I want to be doing it.
It's really, interesting.
In a similar way to the way cats have been domesticated. Because people don't consider them to be fully domesticated.
Really?
Like that's one of the ones that they think they domesticated themselves, you know? Yeah. But it was like a mutual kind of, they started killing mice and people started feeding them. Yeah. So,
that's so interesting.
That's why they have pointy ears still. They're bastards.
So, my question this time round is, what is the world's oldest potted plant?
Wait a second, I just realised.
Snake plant. Asparagus fern.
You got this. You got this.
crap. What's...
It's like that game Concentration.
Swiss cheese plant. I don't know any of the proper names.
Whoa.
You know what Swiss cheese plant is. It's got, you know, holes in the leaves. What's it called? Calathea exotica.
There's so much happening here.
Should I just carry on listing? I was just going to list 10 minutes until I got it.
You are a person of your word. What I was going to say is I just realized potted plants are the domesticated animals of plants.
Oh, fucking hell. Oh my god.
Maybe?
It all links together.
And crosswords are the
domesticated letters of the page.
Jesus Christ.
We need to be stopped immediately.
We do. Please, please.
Stupid.
So stupid. Comedy.
Comedy.
Can Can I ask, can we get a time period in which this happened? Because I feel like it'd be pretty old, right?
That was going to be like a sub question that I'm going to ask you in a minute is like, how old do we think this plant is?
So, sorry, can you ask again? What was the first potted plant?
So I'm actually going to talk a little bit about the history of potted plants if you want to hear about it. I guess, like, my first sort of sub-question is, how long do you think we've been potting plants for?
I mean, clay is old as time. That's, like, one of the oldest building materials.
It's been quite a while, yeah.
And plants are everywhere. Also, I'm gonna put my money on cactus, by the way.
So we've been potting plants for a really, really long time.
Okay.
Outdoor potted plants can be traced back to ancient Egyptians.
Were they in pots, though?
They were in very large pots outside.
Okay, fine.
And it just about counts.
I want to say I was off by about 3,000 years. In my guess, so.
So yeah, ancient Egyptians, in China and India at around the same sort of time, we had outdoor potted plants. Obvious examples are in like Chinese, Japanese and Vietnamese culture, where we have these dwarfed trees. They're a very early example of potted plants.
Bonsai. Wow.
So I was going to say the most famous example is bonsai, but I believe the first sort of version isn't actually a bonsai of like these meticulously pruned dwarfed trees. It's actually called something called penjing or penzai, which originated in China. And that was... we have evidence of that occurring at least 1 AD, if not slightly earlier as well. So we've been potting plants for a really, really long time. In terms of indoor potted plants, early examples date back to the ancient Greeks and Romans as well. So again, for a really long time.
That's I do feel that that's the aesthetic that they had.
Yeah,
so
yeah, absolutely,
yeah.
The practice of potting plants then died out a lot in the Middle Ages.
Because everyone was like, we're dealing with a fucking plague.
Literally,
we're dealing with,
yeah.
Like, plants. We're dealing with like the rise of capitalism. We can't deal with potted plants as well. Jesus.
I want to say it's so interesting because as you're going through these time periods, what I'm doing in my mind is like I'm picturing the prototypical image of it, but then I'm scanning that image for where a plant would be. You know what I mean?
Oh my God, that's like, yeah, literally the exact same thing I was doing. I'm like, I'd literally pictured like a Greek kind of Roman home,
yeah,
and then
yeah,
in the corner I see plant.
A potted plant.
I was like, okay, and that makes sense. I'm like finding Forrest Gump in old photos. Yeah. Like I'm literally like, and then I go back to go to the Middle Ages and I'm like,
of course,
that doesn't seem like it fits there.
I was literally doing the exact same thing. I'm like, of course, I've never seen
that's
a plant
so
in the Middle Ages.
it's just so amazing to like have this new thing to like think
to
through
think
history
about,
of,
yeah,
of like that. That's so funny.
I am essentially continuing my series on the history of dumb things, but in the question topic.
So speaking of it dying out, when I think in my mind about history of plants of being in images, I think like, you know, Regency periods of, because they,
yeah,
they love their like greenhouses, right?
Yeah.
They love like exotic kind of plants being around. That's,
yeah.
When is that when it kind of started coming back up again?
Yeah, so I will get to that very briefly. I will just say that during the Middle Ages, plants were used for their practical uses rather than for aesthetics.
Of course, yeah.
Being planted for things like medicine, especially since there were plagues going on at the time, like you said earlier, Ella, and for food. And indoor cultivated plants were largely restricted to religious buildings, monasteries, and people who had money. So
yeah,
exactly what you're saying. So can we sort of guess what might have revived people's interests in potted plants, especially in Europe, especially in the UK, maybe around the 1700s?
Which is the Regency period.
It is, yeah.
I don't have the slightest clue. Tea? I'm trying to think of British things.
Yeah.
Oh, it's tea. No,
so,
tea.
Not just
tea,
but the British Empire in general being
okay,
a thing. Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense because, like, this idea of them having greenhouses where they grew exotic plants because they because we just started getting fruits from all of the nations we were destroying.
Yeah, literally, we were.
But where will we keep the plants we steal? Perhaps in pots.
So this potted plant renaissance is literally what this is referred to. It occurs during the 1700s, so that's during the Georgian era here in the UK. And it's like the sort of time where the Industrial Revolution is beginning. A lot of trade's happening because we are reaching the peak of the British Empire. And there's a lot of wars happening as well. So a lot of our soldiers are in a lot of different countries bringing things back with them.
War!
Obviously, this is a very, very simplified version of the events that occurred at this time.
Sure, sure, sure.
No, that's how it was.
It's basically like what it was.
We have a quorum among the Brits that's how it was.
basically increased trade with other countries meant that there was an increased interest in the wildlife in other countries, which we then, like we do with everything else because we're British, wanted to have it here instead of leaving it where it should be. This really peaked during the Victorian era, which was the peak of the British Empire. And we were really heavily importing plants from the Americas, Australia, Africa, Asia, etc. In 1840, this place called Kew Gardens is established.
Woo! We love Kew. We still love Kew. I'm pretty sure there are still plants in Kew Gardens that are like obtained under very dubious circumstances.
Yeah. So a little bit about Kew Gardens for anybody who doesn't know. According to Kew Gardens Wiki, I believe it's based in London, and it is the largest and most diverse botanical and mycological collection in the world. Lots of plants, lots of fungus there. And a lot of plants were arriving to Kew Gardens during this period as well. By the 1920s, the public can buy actual house plants for the first time. Before that point, you'd have to plant the seeds or the bulbs yourself and grow them from there. And this also helped this plant revolution. And in the 2000s, houseplants are going through like another trend again, especially like 2020. We're seeing a lot of resurgence in the interest in potted plants.
We call this the millennial depression renaissance.
Maybe this will fix me.
either it'll fix me or I can't afford to have pets or children, so I will have houseplants instead. Yeah.
That's one baby steps to responsibility.
So, now that we know a bit about the history of potted plants, shall we figure out some of the answers to maybe the easier questions around the world's oldest potted plant? Because it is very much like it, you either know the answer or you don't. But there are some things that we can figure out about it necessarily knowing the species.
No, I will refuse to be told. I will guess this. You'll just have to give me more and more clues until I figure it out, okay?
Yeah, I'm. So you're saying that there is like a pretty clear definitive?
There is an answer to this question.
That's really fascinating to me because I feel like you could just dump one in a pot and call it a day.
Well, so can we have a... So this is an outdoor one. Right.
So this is a plant that is kept indoors.
Oh, so we're saying the first indoor potted plant, not the first outdoor potted plant.
That's a great question. I don't think there's really a distinction. This is like, so it's not necessarily the first potted plant. It is the oldest potted plant that we currently have. So like the plant that has been alive the longest in a pot.
Wait, I'm sorry.
Whoa.
Are you... the question you're asking is not
Shut up. Carolyn, we have been misinterpreting this question entire fucking time. Carolyn, are you fucking kidding me? My God. This is so funny.
That's so funny. I thought the oldest type of plant that we've ever potted.
Yes.
I didn't think you meant the actual oldest.
No. Yes.
Amazing.
We know
the actual oldest potted plant. Yeah.
How did you turn this into a twist accidentally?
So funny.
I just have a spark for it. What can I say?
Oh my fucking God, Carol, I swear to God. Okay.
Okay, we're all on the same page now.
Yes. What you're saying is the plant that is alive.
Yeah.
That has been the oldest potted plant.
Yeah.
That has been in a potted plant and is still alive and is the oldest.
Yeah.
We were thinking
like this
which
plant,
species of plant was like the first to be potted. Yeah.
Potted in 2000 BC or something.
Yeah. And I was like, how would you figure? It's amazing that you have that information. But
Exactly.
Let's bring it back in. So we've can we have a, based on what you've told us about the history then, I would guess that it's not more than, it's British.
It is. Well, it's, you can find it in Britain.
No, it's in the oldest one is in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what I would have thought because, and it's, is it in Kew Gardens?
It is. Yes.
Ooh. I was going to guess it could totally be like 100, maybe even 200 years old is my guess for the range.
You're pretty close, yeah.
Is it a tree?
Yeah, I'd call it a tree. It's got
a relevant story about Kew Gardens and plants. On my street, there is a big palm tree, but not like long, thin one, like with a really fat base.
Ooh, I love
them. And it's huge. It's huge. And a man, a very old man, came to pick up some stuff from us one day, and he saw this.
Okay.
There's this. Basically, came up to pick up some free wires from us. It doesn't matter. And he emailed my housemate afterwards saying, "That palm on your tree is the biggest palm I've ever seen. It's bigger than the one in Kew Gardens. I've seen many palms."
Don't tell me that's actually that you've just Slumdog Millionaired yourself into this answer.
I know. Is it a palm? No.
It is palm like.
Oh.
Oh my god. Oh, that's so funny. Ella.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Oh no, don't tell me. I can't. No, if you tell me, I need to get. Give us another step.
How big do you think this plant might be?
Human sized.
It's interesting because, you know, like when it comes to plants, like I think of like old huge redwoods, right? Like that's sort of like when it, because, you know, like, and then, you know, as opposed to animals with like size, and although maybe it's a similar sort of like dichotomy of like size and age, but I would think pretty big is would be my guess, but I could be wrong.
So in terms of weight, it weighs more than a ton.
Okay.
Or about 2,204 pounds. It is in a pot, yeah. Inside a building. It measures over 4 meters in height, or around 13.1 feet-ish.
That's...
Okay.
But that's quite small, actually. That's not 4 meters.
Dense.
Possibly not as big as you guys thought it would be, yeah.
It's like 2 meters. Yeah. Okay.
Still big for a potted plant.
It's big for a potted plant. It grows about 2.5 centimeters every year, or around an inch every year.
Oh, wow.
What's its country of origin?
Can you use it in a sentence?
So it came from the Eastern Cape province in South Africa.
Okay.
That's a big clue on its name as well.
Cape. Capers.
Stupid.
Capybara.
Can just see the like the cogs whirling in your brain right now. It is fantastic.
I feel like if I...
How, Ella? How would you? Unless you have another story of a wise old man who gave you some wisdom.
I feel like this man might have been talking about like the same plant, though.
maybe it is, but that means that there's a bigger one on my street, which means it's kind of like...
It's underwhelming.
Not a pineapple plant.
No.
Does it bear fruit?
No, so it bears cones, I guess.
Okay.
But fun fact about this plant, it's only ever produced one in its life.
Oh.
Whoa.
It tends to produce two or three kind of like sporadically, kind of infrequently.
Uh-huh.
But for it to just produce one is quite interesting about this plant.
Wow.
Oh, that probably means it's not very happy.
Don't call out Kew Gardens like this.
Carolyn, please.
So,
you can just tell me. Ella, you can cover your ears. You can just tell me.
You know what? I'm not going to know you? The specific species, but if I think I feel like I'm fairly close to saying it's like a palm kind of tree, a palm-like tree.
So, the plant is called the Eastern Cape Giant Cycad. C-Y-C-A-D. I'm going to try and pronounce the species name, but I think I'm going to butcher it. So the species is, Encephalatus? Encephalatus.
Encephalatus. Altensteini.
Altensteinii? Something like that. Yeah. Which is like a palm-like plant. It has a somewhat woody trunk. It doesn't tend to have these in its earlier life, but it develops it over time.
Oh, I love it.
It's good, isn't it?
It's so bendy.
So for the listeners, it does. It basically looks like a wide bendy palm tree how I would describe it.
With like palm-like leaves sprouting out of the top.
Yeah.
A little bit about cycads. They have been around since before dinosaurs walked on the earth.
Wow.
These prehistoric plants were widespread over 250 million years ago. However, many species are now under threat of extinction. And this species in particular is listed as vulnerable on the IUCN Red List.
Have we said how old it is, by the way?
Oh, we haven't really talked about it. So if I will briefly talk about how this plant got here, because I do think it's kind of funny. It actually went through quite a journey to get here. It first arrived in its pot in the UK in 1775.
Holy hell. Wow. Okay.
I do believe, isn't it like the American Revolution started in 1776?
1776, yeah.
So...
No, don't tell me this is older than America. Holy hell.
Yeah, it is. I'm so sorry.
Wow.
It would have been potted in the early 1770s and probably wasn't a lot older than that when it was like in the ground still. So this potted plant is about 250 years old.
You know, we should put on the moon this potted plant instead of the American flag.
Oh,
shots fired there. Oh my goodness.
My God.
I couldn't find any specific information about how old it actually is, but I say around 250 years old. It's been potted in the UK for 247 years.
Wow. So that's
pretty cool. In terms of actually getting it here, it came from the Eastern Cape Province in South Africa. It was put on board a wooden sailing ship where it had to endure the many month-long journey to London.
Wow. Yeah. My God.
During its travels, the plant was strapped to the deck to give it access to rainwater and sunlight. And then it was transported by barge along the Thames, which I just think is hilarious.
Ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
That's so funny. Why? Like, it's just...
Why?
I guess...
Why?
It's a cool plant. It's a cool plant.
I'm not sure where it lived before it went to Kew Gardens. Obviously, Kew Gardens wasn't established until 1840. So it did spend some of its time not there. But I think it moved there not long after Kew Gardens was established, and it stayed there ever since.
Oh, well, good for it.
Good for it.
Cycad.
So in terms of what Kew Gardens sort of justifies keeping this plant for, Kew Gardens' website says that it's monitoring the Eastern Cape Giant Cycad as part of the Sampled Red List Index for Plants, which aims to produce conservation assessments for a representative sample of the world's plant species. The information apparently will lead to a better understanding of extinction risks and help focus conservation efforts where they are needed most. It's a very good spiel from Kew Gardens. They probably just don't want to give it up at this point. but they've also got so many other plant species around it. This plant currently lives in the Palm House, which is just a very, very big greenhouse, along with a lot of other species as well. So, we know how big the plant is, how old the plant is. I guess my next question is, how do you look after a plant that is this old and this big?
It's like...
I would hope it's low maintenance if it's lived this long,
that's
but
a really,
maybe not.
Yeah.
It's just it's from South Africa, so it doesn't need a lot of water, I imagine.
Yeah.
It just kind of needs to be warm and maybe occasionally watered. Like,
yeah, so the biggest thing to look after this plant right now is to make sure it doesn't fall over. Because if you look at the photos, it leans very, very heavily to one side.
Yeah.
So currently, if you can go and visit this plant, and you will see three quite large metal beams holding the plant up, basically.
And I think the really important question is, can I touch the plant?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I'm going to try.
Go see if you get kicked out. Yeah.
Okay. I'll let you know how it goes.
So, other than being held upright, as you guys both said, it is a pretty low maintenance plant. It doesn't require much pruning other than to remove dead leaves. It doesn't produce new leaves very often either. Watering varies throughout the year. But it receives like a large glug of water every now and then, basically.
Do you think there's actually like science behind caring for it, or they're really just like, just
see
give
what
it
happens.
Give it a bit of water.
I will read some quotes of the people who look after it, because they are quite funny in a minute. But yeah, very, very occasionally needs a lot of water. They do it in big glugs because there are concerns about irrigation for the plant. And as far as I'm aware, it's only needed repotting once. I don't know if that's once in recent years or once throughout its entire existence. I just know that it was last repotted in 2009. That took 3 months to plan.
Boy, and, howdy.
And needed 9 people to help lift it, because obviously it weighs a ton.
Wow.
So they repotted the plant, they used specialised soil to help with its irrigation. So yeah, that's sort of how they look after this plant. My final question, I guess, is how long will this plant actually live for?
Ooh.
I guess there must be wild specimens that are older than this plant, right? So
yeah.
However long that lives.
In terms of cycads, we don't know. I couldn't find anything specifically about this species.
My guess is like 400 or 500, maybe. But
So some cycads within the genus have been known to live for 150 years. Others, over 1,000 years old. So it could be around. And those are all wild specimens, obviously. So this one could be around for a very long time to come. Or... I have some great quotes from people who have looked after the plant over the years. This one is Will Spelestra, who says, "Hopefully it will live a lot longer yet, as I don't want to be known as the man who killed the oldest potted plant in the world."
Oh, no.
Which I think is really funny. There is also another hilarious quote from Ursula Bouchon, who in 2009 was one of the students at Kew Gardens who helped look after the plant. They regularly worked in the palm house, which that's where the cycad is kept. And she says, "I developed a neurotic fantasy that if I did this vital task of watering in an incompetent way, I might, just might, kill off the plant. How would I cope if the finger of blame was pointed at me? Would the shame of it cast blight on my career? I have always had a propensity of killing houseplants. This cycad was a houseplant that was very large indeed. I consoled myself with the thought that if I did harm it, it would take a long time for such a knobbly old thing to show any moribund tendencies, by which time I would be long gone." I think that's really funny.
Okay.
Part of me is assured that these people have the same anxieties about it.
Yeah.
I think that's very human to feel that way about caring for such an old plant. I would rather that than them being like, "Yeah, you just water it twice a week, it's
happens,
fine, no big deal."
Just so we don't leave people hanging, I will just say that the oldest tree in the world is 5,062 years old.
Jesus.
In the White Mountains in California. And it's a basin bristlecone pine. That's the known oldest, but obviously we haven't tested every tree in the world.
Unbelievable.
That's so cool.
We're going to do a little clarification because somebody else in the Discord server rightly pointed out that some bonsai trees are much older than the potted plant at Kew Gardens. So the plant at Kew Gardens holds the world record because it's been so heavily documented. The bonsai trees in question have not been so heavily documented, so that's possibly why they're not counted. But also, we don't know when those bonsai trees were put into a pot. So that might be why they're not counted as part of the world record holder. Basically, they are absolutely correct. There are plants out there who have been in pots for longer than the one at Kew Gardens. There's just a few reasons why we don't count it as the world record holder. Thanks, guys.
Cool.
Neat. Lots of old plants. We love them all.
I want to finish this topic off with a quote from Wes Shaw, who was another keeper at the Palm House in 2009, who was reported as saying, "When I think of how many gardeners have cared for this plant over the years, it gives me a real sense of importance of the living collection that we are responsible for here at Kew, and the incentive to ensure it keeps thriving through my time at Palm House," which I just think is a really lovely place to leave it.
I hadn't considered that. Yeah. That is really sweet.
It's a very human thing, isn't it? To just want to keep this plant alive for as long as possible and just see how long you can do it for.
This chain of caring has existed older than some countries. Well, we don't have to name who, not that it's a big deal. Not that it matters. So, normally, I'd start the missed topic asking y'all's familiarity with crossword puzzles. But this time, I want to disclose at the top that I used to hate crosswords. I absolutely despised them. I did not get them. Anytime I used to think about crosswords, I was reminded of this one Calvin and Hobbes comic where Calvin goes, he's like, "I'm doing a crossword puzzle. Number three across says bird." And he goes, "I got it. It's the yellow-bellied sapsucker." And then Hobbes goes, "But there's only five boxes." And then Calvin goes, "I know, these idiots make you write real small." that's how I felt about them, because I was like, what is this supposed to be? And you know, I had never completed a crossword before. They felt really hopeless to me. And I don't think crosswords are for everyone. You know, there's a sort of like insufferable punniness to them. But hopefully, as a recent convert, I'll be able to show y'all why I think they're so neat. So now I will ask, what is y'all's familiarity with crossword puzzles?
I've again never completed a crossword puzzle. Because I just feel like if you don't know the answer, you don't know. And that just takes a lot of the joy away from it. It's like, I want to know immediately. I'm just not going to get it.
It is very much like, it feels like a general knowledge thing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So I often try and do crosswords and I can never do them. And what's more frustrating is I often try to do cryptid crosswords, which are 20 times as hard, and I don't think I've ever done a single cryptid crossword. Like, I don't think I've ever got a single answer. My brain just does not work that way.
So I was going to mention that, in the UK and Australia, cryptic crosswords are, I could be wrong, but like are generally more of a thing. Like, they're not a thing really much here.
Oh, really? Okay, so there's a...
Interesting.
My familiarity with cryptic crosswords started because there's this show here called Inside Number 9, and one of the episodes is about murder, but they're basically are solving a cryptid crossword that reveals, it's quite cheesy, that reveals that the murder has happened over through the cryptid crossword.
And then the murderer pops out, it's like, "You got it, hooray, take me away."
The murderer has poisoned the person and they're slowly revealing through the cryptid crossword that they've been poisoned.
Oh my god.
It's great.
I love the idea of like Will Shorts like dying of poison and being like, "I need to write the answer in a clue."
It's such a good, it's actually, the show is amazing. It's a great episode.
That's great.
But I was like, what is this cryptid crossword thing? And then I ended up, because they're in most newspapers in the UK, and I ended up looking, and I was like, this is fucking impossible. It's just...
I'm not gonna cover too much of cryptic crosswords, just because I didn't even know they were a thing. I just discovered them, that it's a very UK phenomena, but we're gonna stick with the standard sort of kind of crosswords. The other one thing I wanted to say, Carolyn, the thing that sort of convinced me to crosswords that I do love about them is that in theory, you only have to know 50% of the answers, right? Because if you get all the horizontal ones, then you can...
True.
And that aspect of it, I do kind of appreciate that you can sort of like, you don't have to know the answers. You can also just sort of like fudge your way through
it.
I don't know. I just kind of see it like, I can just do Sudoku instead, you know?
I was just going to say the same thing. Like, I can do a Sudoku. If I want, like, a word-based puzzle, I can just do a Wordle.
We'll get into
some of
the things I appreciate specifically about crosswords in a second. But for those who don't know, crosswords are grids of boxes that you fill in with letters to answers, clues that go down and across. And the answers intersect, which lets you have hints as to what other answers might be. And crossword clues range from the really straightforward to the punny. So a simple one that I saw recently was...
it was five letters.
And it just said, actor Carell of The Office.
Steve.
Yep, exactly.
Nice.
but the clues
can... Sorry, Tom, can we just do... Instead of you talking about crosswords, because you just say crossword clues and then we'll just answer them for the whole topic.
We're gonna mention a few, don't worry.
That could be the whole topic.
But the clues can be as complex as one of my favorites, which is 11 letters. And the clue is, the right one can produce a smile. And I'm not going to make you guess, because you have to, it's easier in the context. But the answer is parenthesis. Because the right one makes a smiley face. The right one can produce a smile.
I hate it so much.
Mm-mm. I will say you definitely have to have an acquired taste for like the groaning cleverness. Like it's never like a belly laugh. It's always like a,
yeah.
Which is definitely an acquired taste, but... the best place to start talking about crosswords is, of course, what's often cited as the first crossword puzzle, which comes from ancient Sumer. That's a joke. It does not come from ancient Sumer.
God damn, I'm so excited then.
Actually, you know, the Rosetta Stone was a crossword, it turns out.
Stop.
I hate this.
Do you all have
so
a guess?
Much.
Have a guess as to when it started?
200 years.
I would assume around, like, the... like invention of the printing press so that they could be replicated.
That's really interesting. It turns out the sort of, and I'm sure there's always been lots of word puzzles, but like what's often cited as the, a crossword, a recognizable crossword, is actually from 1913 only.
Okay, yeah.
That seems I'm suspicious of that answer. I feel like people would have thought of doing that earlier.
So it was invented by Arthur Wynn, and it was called Fun's Word Cross Puzzle. I'm going to send you all a picture, just because it's silly.
Okay, yeah.
The numbering system is an absolute mess. Some of the clues are really...
Oh, I hate this.
Uh-huh, it looks like homework. So the most hilarious clue by far for me is, it's a five-letter word, and the clue is, what we all should be. Do you want to know what the answer is?
Oh, I do.
It's, the answer is moral.
Fuck off.
Ah, but of course we should all be moral.
Of course.
I think that's so funny. I didn't come here to be lectured by my grandpa. My God. anyway, in spite of the moralizing and the messy numbers, this started to become a big hit in the US. It was popping up in magazines and papers. But for me, what makes this history of the crossword so interesting isn't that it's like super old or that it's super recent, but is how much it was despised at the time.
I bet.
It was like treated like such a fad. Like literally the same way that people talk about
Wordle.
Like Pokemon Go or Wordle.
It's
exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
You're gonna love some of these quotes. It's really funny. So we have some spicy printed proof of all of this hate. So in 1925, in the New Yorker's very first issue, they said this quote. They said, "Judging from the number of solvers in the subway and L trains, the crossword puzzle bids fair to become a fad with New Yorkers." And then later, in the same issue, someone else said, "As it grows throughout the rest of the country, crossword puzzling wanes in New York. At least, it wanes in the small group that helped make it fashionable when it was revived a year or two ago."
Oh, come on. This, honestly, I'm fed up of people talking about Wordle because it's so overexposure. But when people post, "Oh, I haven't gotten into Wordle. Oh, I've..."
It's the same thing.
I'm like, please just shut up. Like, if you don't want to do it, don't fucking do it. Like, I don't care.
And Ella, it turns out we've been insufferable for at least a century.
I know, honestly, this is so nice. It's so nice to know that people have always been this awful.
I just love how angry we're all getting at this.
And like with that last quote, literally the layers of like, it used to be cool, but like not anymore for like the people who started off doing it. Like, my God.
How pretentious can you be?
Oh my God. I knew crosswords when they were underground.
Who knew there were hipsters around crosswords?
The underground crossword movement. We used to secretly pass them to each other in the dark because we were afraid of being arrested for our nefarious crosswords.
My God.
Please.
My God. There's a great cartoon from a British magazine in that same year, 1925. It was titled The Crossword Mania, and it's a picture of a guy calling his doctor at 2 a.m, and he goes, "I want the name of a bodily disorder of 7 letters, of which the second letter must be N." I think that's genuinely pretty funny.
That's quite funny.
That is really funny.
But it's extra funny because, like, you can imagine that same cartoon about, like, a political cartoon about, like, Wordle or Pokemon Go.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah. Really... It probably exists somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure. But there was one paper that was perhaps the most scathing. They called crosswords a, quote, sinful waste in the utterly futile finding of words, the letters of which will fit into a prearranged pattern more or less complex. This is not a game at all, and it hardly can be called a sport.
Well, it's not a sport, so...
People are so petty.
That same paper later in the year wrote, "Fortunately, the question of whether the puzzles are beneficial or harmful is in no urgent need of an answer. The craze evidently is dying out fast, and in a few months it will be forgotten."
Oh, this is so funny. Goodness. This is so ridiculous.
And that paper...
Can we name and shame who said this?
New York Times. The New York Times.
It was?
No.
The New York Times.
Of course it was.
Which, of course, would go on to make what is today considered the crossword of record. Like, they make what is
and they bought Wordle.
And they bought Wordle.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sure did.
At least they learned from their mistakes.
Yeah. So 20 years after writing those remarks in 1942, the New York Times would start publishing crosswords as a form of levity during World War II.
Okay.
And the first crossword editor was Margaret Farrar, who was the first puzzle editor at the Times, and she would go on to establish basically all of the modern conventions of crosswords.
Good for her.
She's like a legend. And the other thing I found absolutely wild is that since 1942, there have only been 4 puzzle editors at the Times. It is like an institution. Like, everyone stays there for like 20 to 30 years.
That's pretty cool.
That is really cool.
The current puzzle editor is, of course, Will Shortz, who is...
Of course.
Maybe the biggest name in the crossword...
Will Shortz.
Listen, all the great NPR-loving folks listening to this will... he is the biggest name in crosswords. But since its origin... with overly moralizing clues, the crossword has grown a lot and become what I think is something so interesting and delightful and more than just a fad. So I want to talk about some of my favorite things. Firstly, I think listeners of the show will appreciate that sometimes you can accidentally learn something from a crossword. One of my favorite clues ever has an answer that's only 3 letters, but the clue reads, "human organ with its own immune system."
Gut?
I mean, the only three left...
No, an organ.
An eye?
Yes, Carolyn got it.
Hey, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
I didn't know that.
No.
And that's the fun of it.
You did.
No,
I'm sorry, guys. You did know that because I talked about it in a topic where I told you that they do stem cell transplants into the eye because it's an immunoprivileged site.
Did say this.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I mean, yes, I did know that. And that's why I got it right.
So it does. It doesn't get a response from... cells that are out of the body. So you should have,
yeah.
you guys don't listen to me.
We're not retaining that information. How dare us?
So, like Ella said, I did a little bit of research because I forgot we had already talked about it. So the eye has something called ocular immune privilege. And this is a quote from a paper from 2010. It goes, "The eye attempts to limit local immune and inflammatory responses to preserve vision. This phenomena, known as ocular immune privilege, is mediated by a combination of local and systemic mechanisms, but its mechanisms are still incompletely understood." So,
thank you, Ella, for teaching us about that.
The reason I find that clue delightful is because it could have easily just been like the windows to the soul, or like some other clue. It doesn't have to be a little factoid, but the puzzle maker that day was like, maybe the puzzle maker that day was like, "Hey, I listened to this great podcast and I learned this fact,
yeah.
So maybe I'll put it in there." My second favorite thing in crosswords is what me and my friends lovingly call fuckery. And what that means is that for the New York Times, every Thursday and Sunday, they'll write unconventional and experimental clues and answers that do nonsense. So the most clever one I've seen was on February 6th, 2022, and the puzzle was titled Sci-Fi Showdown. And the answer directly in the middle of the puzzle was eight letters across, and the clue was the better of two major sci-fi franchises.
Oh, because it could be either, right? It could be Star Trek or Star Wars, and you have to get some other bits in the crossword to figure it out. That's very funny.
Actually, Ella, you almost got it. The trick is that Star Trek and Star Wars were both the correct answer.
Oh, they were both the answer.
That's so clever.
What makes that extra amazing is because then, because it works with both, the vertical clues have to also work for both. So one of the down clues was body part that precedes the word band. So if you put Star Wars, the A in Wars makes it waistband.
Mm-hmm.
But if you put Star Trek, the R in Trek makes it wristband. And they both work,
nice.
Which is... we were freaking out when we realized this.
That's fun.
But sometimes the fuckery is truly wild because there is something in crosswords known as a rebus. And the best way to explain a rebus is from the title of an article by the New York Times, which reads, yes, you can write more than one letter in a square.
Ooh.
Nope. No, you can't.
I firmly disagree.
So,
no.
In the January 30th, 2022 puzzle was titled Watch Your Step, and we were trying to solve it, and we were so confused because there were clues that we, like, knew the answers to, but there weren't enough spaces, until one of the clues gave away the hint that you were supposed to write the word trap into a single space to form a trap door, and then that answer clues like Von Trapp family, which we knew the answer to, but, like, couldn't fit in. There's another answer that was like best rap album, and so the trap's in there. But what's so fucky about that is, if you'll remember, that is literally what was happening in the Calvin and Hobbes comic.
Oh my god.
That they were joking about doing. Like, so Calvin was right, sometimes these idiots do make you write real small.
But do they tell you in advance if it's that kind of crossword?
They don't, but usually another clue will, like, give you a hint that there's some... And also the Thursdays and the Sundays are, like, it's, like, wild card.
Mm-hmm. So you're expecting a level of fuckery there.
So they usually give, like, a hint that something's going on.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll do visual stuff also, but yeah.
Interesting.
So another interesting thing about crosswords is how they sort of exist as a sign of the changing culture. I think the most notorious example is this is probably in 2006 when the clue was scoundrel and the answer was scumbag. And the New York Times got a ton of complaints, mostly from older folks, because the word's original meaning is condom. But over the years, its popular meaning has completely changed. But as recently as 1998, a U.S. representative called Bill Clinton a scumbag, and the New York Times actually censored it. They called it a vulgarity for a condom. But since then, the popular meaning has changed to the point where Will Shortz said, quote, the thought never crossed my mind that the word would be controversial.
Yeah, that's really that's interesting.
Like, weird, yeah.
There's a more recent one includes a clue that read, most likely to inspire, quote, thirst. The answer was sexiest, and me and my friends were all like, Will Shortz, thirsty on Maine. My God.
Oh,
what are you doing?
Nice. That's nice that they like keep it current. But do you think it's Will Short though? Do you think
they're
it's
down
like
with
he's
kids.
Got like young interns working there, right? Who also his current lingo.
There's writers and editors, yeah. But I mean, it's neat, and there's one. Speaking of neat, there's the one that we could not get over was there was a clue on March 10th, 2022, and the clue was neat, and the answer was noise.
Noise?
With an O. Yeah.
No.
I love that.
We were filling in the horizontals, and we were like, jokingly, like, haha, wouldn't it be funny if it was noise? And then we were like, Oh my god, it is noise. It is noise.
That's a bad one.
At what point does noise become part of, like, the dictionary?
Hey folks, Tom from the future here. One of our listeners, who used to be a bartender, let us know in the Discord that the answer is actually supposed to be no ice. Neat. Which makes significantly more sense. Anyway, back to the episode.
I don't mind, slang terms, you know, language changes. And they should
be. Yeah, yeah.
But if it's not, like, very widely used, putting it in the New York Times crossword is a bit odd.
You know, I think noise and thirst are sort of, like, on the boundary. But I think what's interesting about these is, firstly, because, you know, with changing times, I think changing with the times is what helps make the crossword survive past being a fad, is being able to grow.
Yeah, absolutely.
And secondly, I think some of these are great because, like, to be completely honest, crossword puzzles are predominantly written by old straight white men.
Yeah.
I remember distinctly there was one clue that had to do with an Indian spice, and my friend was like, he was like, paprika fits, but it's not correct.
No.
And I would know. And we were like, my friend who does crosswords more often was like, don't forget, you have to remember, sometimes the answer isn't what's correct, it's what an old white man would think is correct. What happens is sometimes that clues will often get edited out if they're considered, like, too difficult or not common knowledge. But what is common knowledge depends in part on the reader. Puzzle writer Jenny Levy put it really well when she said, clues and answers that are stereotypically masculine are general interest. Clues and answers that are stereotypically feminine are niche or obscure.
Ah.
And, you know, of course, this goes for queer folks and people of color and disabled folks, too. And so I love to see words that sort of start to push on the notion of what is general interest, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't just have to be old war facts, you know? It can be things that are current or
affect people who haven't typically been writing crosswords.
That's such a good point. Like, in the UK, obviously we have a lot of pub quizzes, as I'm sure you do, but I've been to a lot of pub quizzes in my life, and recently we started going to one where I knew so much of the stuff in there, and I was like, gosh, this is just easy, they're just making it easy. No, what I realized was it was for people my age, like the clues,
yeah,
and I was like, oh shit, you know, this is finally not just about World War II.
yeah
and it changed the whole game.
Totally. There's an interesting example where a puzzle writer wanted to write Lorelei with an AI because it was going to be a Gilmore Girls clue.
Oh.
But then the editor was like, no, that's too similar to Lorelei with an EI, which are German sirens of myth.
What?
What the hell?
That, like, is the perfect dichotomy of, like, which is more general knowledge.
You say Lorelei and I think Gilmore Girls, obviously.
Yeah. So that was just, like, a really interesting example. But, of course, you know, when the boundaries aren't being pushed enough, when the crossword fails you, sometimes you need to take matters into your own hands, which is why I want to talk about, finally, my favorite thing about crosswords and the reason I got hooked in the first place, which is doing crosswords the wrong way with friends. So you may have noticed I used the word us and we a lot in this section.
Uh-huh.
And it's because there's an amazing website where you can do them online collaboratively. It's called Down for a Cross, like a cross, but also like down for a crossword.
Thanks
of course
for
it's a pun
explaining
name.
The pun, Tom.
Thank you. We love
welcome.
That from
you. It's amazing. It's community run. And so a friend of mine who is really into crosswords basically convinced us to give it a shot. You know, she was showing us the ropes. And I first fell in love with it, not for the cleverness, but for the chaos of doing it incorrectly with friends. Because when you do it with friends, you get to, first of all, complain about ridiculous clues. You get to curse Will Shorts and take his name in vain. You get to hype each other up when someone cracks a clue or, like, knows something very specific. But most importantly, you get to come up with dumb joke answers. It's basically tradition now that once we start, we all race to fill the board with dumb answers before actually taking the puzzle seriously. And so these are some of my favorite joke answers. There was one clue. It was seven letters, and the clue was bon blank with an exclamation mark. So the answer was bon appetit, but I put bon hiver, OMG! just stupid. Another clue was the part of the body that was first successfully transplanted in 1905. It was six letters. The answer was cornea, but of course we put boner with two O's because otherwise it wouldn't fit.
So stupid.
This is such a you sense of humor right here. Oh my goodness.
It's good. I'm glad there are other people like you out there.
You say that like there's an endangered species of these.
Like, really,
we found people.
If Tom's friends are listening to this, you guys are great, truly.
Another clue was cutesy term of affection, and someone put Tommy Wami, just to make fun of me. But then I think the best one, it was a clue. It was seven letters. The answer was seven letters, and the clue was source of suffering, and we of course put friends.
Oh,
it's the only appropriate answer, isn't it?
After all that, yeah. I want to say, like, I have all respect for puzzle creators and folks who do tournaments and like live and breathe by crosswords, doing crosswords in pen every day. But I wish someone had told me earlier that they can be as much about having fun. I value very few things more than the excuse the crossword has given me to think and laugh with my friends. And so in the end, my favorite way to do a crossword is exactly like Calvin did, which is jamming in letters to make a friend laugh with a dumb joke.
Oh, I love that.
As soon as you said about this down for a cross thing, I'm so excited because I'm in this group chat where people every day they send their Wordles every day, but not just Wordle, every kind of Wordle imaginable.
The Quordle, the
maths one, the country one, Hurdle, which is a sound one, which is my favorite. And so we're constantly all doing this, and it's like,
oh yeah,
finally we can do something together.
It's an amazing website, and it works. So, it just like works, and then you.
Thank you so
that
much.
That was really nice.
I love you, that.
You've
yeah.
actually you've convinced me, which is I didn't thought you would.
It worked.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Well done.
I swear to God, I was so against them for so long, and then once I realized that they can be dumb, I was like, cool.
As soon as you could make it stupid, you were convinced.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's review corner.
Bum, bum, bum. We can make a little theme.
I think we should make sounds.
Okay, good. So we have a wonderful review by Whelmed by Theister, and they say, joyous. I'm really not usually a podcast girl. I get easily distracted, and I can have a difficult time multitasking if I need to focus on listening. That being said, the excitement with which these three talk about such interesting and wonderful topics that I would never think to research on my own is such an easy and joyous listen. Those are all caps. Enough that I'll be listening to all of the episodes and be excited for more. Genuinely, such a wonderful time.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. What was their username?
Don't make him say
Whelmed
it again.
By Theister?
Whelmed by
Thank
Theister.
You, Whelmed.
Thank you, Whelmed.
That was really kind.
And does anyone want to plug their pluggables? Wow, okay.
I'm starring in the new Avengers. I'm the villain. It's going to be really cool. Everyone go watch it. Otherwise, I'm Tom Lumperson everywhere.
I'm Caroline the Bug everywhere.
I'm Big Science Energy on TikTok and Ella Hubba on Twitter. And today we have learnt that there are very cute domesticated foxes, which may or may not be genetically similar to the way we domesticated other animals like dogs. We learnt that the oldest potted plant in the world is not the oldest kind of potted plant in the world. But it's the oldest actual potted plant in the world, and it's a
cycad
in Kew Gardens, and it's lovely. And we learnt that there are many ways you can do a crossword, and one of the ways is you can do it with friends, which sounds wonderful. And please join us next time where we will learn about
everything.
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubber, Tom Lunn and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lunn.
I just got a message from my mum saying I'm watching your spicy challenge.
Oh my god. That's so sweet.
Which means that she supports us on Patreon. How cute is that?
Probably at the $1 tier.
Yeah.
That's fine. She can totally.
That is so
That's
sweet.
So sweet.